Welcome to this special episode of the Upwards Podcast, where we discuss the intersection of Christian faith in the academy, church, and marketplace. In today's episode, we will hear four recorded clips from talks at Upper House this semester. Upper House Commons gathers the university community for spiritual, intellectual, and vocational formation. Links to the full recorded talks are in the show notes. We hope you enjoy this episode of the Upwards Podcast. In this clip, Ann Snyder, editor-in-chief of Comment Magazine, joined us to explore the possibilities offered by a revived Christian humanist approach that flows from Scripture and 2,000 years of Christ-centered tradition. In her view, such an approach offers a hopeful and creative way to navigate the destabilizing currents of this late modern moment. Ann's presentation interwove history, hope, and insights about our post-election wariness. She offered a Christian humanist manifesto that addressed vital questions and concerns shared by people across our community and nation, regardless of their political affiliation or religious affections.
I love university campuses for the learning environment that they are, and I've decided to take permission from your own nature as an institution. Instead of laying out perhaps an impressive or long-running thesis, just in the context of so many moving dynamics in our historical moment right now, I thought I would risk sharing some live wire observations that I'm seeking to name and work out. Felt realities that, frankly, are a little hard to bring to speech, but I think might be digging at something. And then I just thought we could see if we could have a bit of a conversation together so we each feel less alone and walk out of here, hopefully a little bit wiser, maybe a little more shrewd and more encouraged for having been in the room together tonight. So I hope that's okay. Some years ago, I think it was 2019, I was getting to know an acquaintance named Sam Kimbriel, whose attentiveness to history and to the deeper currents of a society's ever-evolving character I found unusually compelling and perceptive. We were trying to help each other in our respective new jobs. I had just become the editor of Comment Magazine, and he was trying to build a two-way street between the academy and media players that would make moral philosophy a translatable felt force in a public square that just seemed increasingly technocratic and unable to engage in questions of why and what for. Somewhere in the more kind of macro conversation we were having about cultural swells and paradoxes that we were noticing in the country in 2019, he caught me off guard by getting super earnest all of a sudden. And he said, "At the end of it all, when I die, the only thing I hope is said about me is that I ended this life with clear eyes." It was an unusual thing to say and an unusual thing to hear. It sounded deep to me, but also very vague. And I honestly didn't really understand what he meant or what to make of it. But out of respect for him and something kind of wise sounding about this deathbed countenance, the notion of clear eyes has stayed with me. There just was a flavor to the aspiration that seemed kind of like that knowing peace I think a lot of us long for at the end of our lives, an arrival at full maturity and other-centeredness, the earning of simplicity and freedom on the far side of complexity, control, and let's face it, ego and self-preservation. It struck a similar chord with me to that well-documented moment when Dorothy Day, who's a personal hero of mine and founder of The Catholic Worker, was asked to write a memoir of her amazing life. And when she sat down to write it, found herself able to say only one sentence and put that on the page, which was, "You know, I just thought of the Lord and his visit to us all those years ago, and I'm just grateful to have had him on my mind all this time." As the years have passed since that conversation I had with Sam, this notion of clear eyes has become more meaningful to me, and at times even urgent. It's a quality that I now find myself actively looking for in other people, a quality I increasingly crave in my own outlook, all too aware of how limited and freighted by self and all sorts of things my own sight is. I think if I were to look back over my prayer journals the last number of years, I would bet there's kind of an accelerating curve upward for the number of times I've pretty desperately asked God, please, can you please help me see well today? Just see the way that you see. As alluded, I do come to you all tonight quite a bit more rattled than I anticipated in these early days of a new, but of course, in another sense, not new, presidential administration. Though I live in D.C., which I recognize as the fishbowl of all fishbowls that admittedly overamps the feelings of intensity anytime there's a shift of power, I am really not a political animal by disposition and certainly not by expertise. Instead, it has been the task and the delight of my work at Comet in particular to try to peer beneath the aggressive diagnosis and kind of fatalism I feel surrounded by so often in a media-saturated city, and to seek understanding of what you might call pre-political currents that animate human belief, behavior, conviction, longing, sometimes even change, like conversion-type change, across a wide array of contexts. Currents like forgiveness and why it's gone out of fashion, how cultural change, for good or ill, happen these days, the ways in which technology's advances are shifting the way we conceive of ourselves and conceive of the private versus public realms, what's happening to our willingness to trust anything or anyone outside of ourselves, how healthy communities bloom and grow. When you dwell here, at the foundationally human level of existence and experience, you just cannot dismiss people based on their political worldview, because that worldview is typically just too contingent on context and life stories, subcultures and the chasms between them, experiences of feeling superseen and sought after, and experiences of feeling invisible and denigrated. And all of that is the terrain I want to understand before ever assessing the state of another person's soul based purely on their political preference, as if I have any right or ability to play moral judge in the first place. At deeper, murkier terrain, ultimately, is what needs to be understood so that then we can make some solid moral judgments, as much for the living of a considered generative life as the effective repair of our world. But recently, observing just sort of how the drip, drip leak of what I might call interpretive charity in our political culture, and especially our national political culture, feels like it's become this sort of full-on flushing down the tube of any grace or elasticity in the public square, I've started to wonder if what I just said is a luxury of democratic health, unaffordable when chaos becomes the main character. There is something in the current moment, both in the U.S. and globally, that is not simply dizzying in the pace of structural change and cultural whiplash, which I acknowledge and am very open to, may yield some good things for human flourishing in time, although I do right now feel more worried than hopeful. It's more that in the minute-to-minute, relationship-by-relationship experience of being a Christian, simply trying to perceive reality clearly, to discern truth from falsehood, good from evil, practicality from spirituality, common sense from cruelty and dehumanization, means from ends, reinvention from destruction. There is something in the search for true north in this current moment that has felt, to me at least, nauseating. And if I'm going to speak more directly, spiritually fraught. Again, I'm not attributing my own sense of nausea only or even primarily to the radical decisions right now being made at the tippy top of state power, although the pace of the last couple weeks' shock and awe tactics is stirring up a fog, I think, for the task of clear thinking. And I'd say real damage to real lives that is happening with a level of drive and a lack of apology that I've probably never seen in as or never understood to be part of the American ethos in my own lifetime. But I think the spiritual and maybe also psychological nausea is really coming from a deeper bloodstream in our culture, one that is now engaging in a full frontal war, especially online, around what is considered real and good and just and humane. These are primary goods, and in some ways, I'm glad we may finally be ready to have explicit, big public arguments about how we interpret these goods to get the differences just honestly out in the open. But what's disturbing in this moment, and here I'm really groping for language, so please give me some grace if this isn't quite right. What's disturbing is the ever more frequent way in which people seem to be wrapping their particular sight and opinion on current events in language that invokes the sacred. For instance, those typically on the right these days are often proclaiming things like, "We, America, are living in biblical times. You can see the whole battle of the Bible being reincarnated through current events in our midst." Or often, sort of its counter on the left, the sort of quick turn to proclaim someone whose political impulses you find to your liking, you often hear, "Oh, that person's prophetic." There's sort of an all too easy way in which big words like evil are being used to describe a national actor like China or a human being like Kamala Harris. It just seems we're shooting from the hip with high voltage words that are interpreting reality through the lens of the existential, with no sanctioned authority but for the vehemence of the personality claiming them. And I know this isn't a new thing in the US. We are a strange civil religious country. But it just feels like there's a flailing, almost last gasp cosmology being whipped up, especially, again, online, that may just be rhetoric weaponized to manipulate, or it may actually be interacting with something real in the spiritual realm. Either way, the speed at which we're so rapidly turning to sacred categories to claim turf and totalize what's really going on doesn't feel like child's play, and that worries me. So what I'm really finding myself starved for right now, in the midst of all the noise and all the polarization and all the different interpretations, is clear eyes, or to put it more holistically and actively, a new school in what it takes to have really good discernment. As some luck would have it, Comment, my team, and I some months back decided to commit our upcoming summer issue to learning about and studying and exploring the mysteries and practices of discernment throughout Christian history in particular, as well as a few other traditions. So I'm hoping to be a lot wiser on the other side of working with our authors and producing that issue. But for now, I'm just trying to commit to some basic things that I think will help me and others get a little closer. And they're things you all know well: prayer and silence, scriptural reading, allowing it to speak, staying part of a covenantal community, even when it's inconvenient or leaves something to be desired, refusing to allow online consumption of media and reactions to the current news environment to outpace the amount of time spent with real people in real context and real flesh, serving together in some concrete way in the neighborhood with others, listening to the primary sources of public action, sort of the horse's mouth, so to speak, across the political spectrum, and maybe turning down the volume a little bit on the interpretive frames given by a wide variety of media sources.
In this talk, Cassandra Nelson discussed promises connected to technology and the ways technology fulfills or fails to fulfill those promises. She compared the benefits of 21st century technology to the benefits of reading good fiction, and she considered with us the question core to our scrolling and reading: what are we looking for? Cassandra Nelson is a visiting fellow at the Lumen Center and an associate fellow at the University of Virginia's Institute for Advanced Studies in Culture.
Anyway, given the timing of the lecture, it seemed like the most sensible thing to do would be to talk about fiction. But another research interest of mine has to do with technology, and specifically with the ways in which electronic technology is altering our understanding of reality, mortality, morality, and authority. And while people often smile at the mention of fiction, it is, after all, what New Yorker writer James Wood calls the fun stuff. Their eyes really light up when the subject of technology is raised. We all love it, technology. And we all kind of know it's somehow killing us, technology. And we've all kind of agreed to ignore any cognitive dissonance arising from that contradictory state of affairs. So this evening, we're going to think more about what's behind that puzzling dynamic. But exactly how to connect those two subjects, fiction and technology, and how to articulate that connection in the form of one concise and compelling question was not at all clear to me in November. So I tossed out kind of the spoken word equivalent of hasty notes on a cocktail napkin. And then the next thing I knew, I saw this evening's lecture advertised in the Upper House newsletter, just like you all did. And the question was perfect. And so I thought, there's a good lesson for me. Never attempt to circumscribe the work of the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit can work through a marketing department because they did in this one. So my main goal here tonight is really just to live up to the vision that Tony Bolos and what I'm told also Julie Bolos and Susan Smetzer Anderson had for this talk. They found the perfect hinge in terms of considering what fiction and technology each promise to do and how well they deliver or don't on those promises. So thank you guys for your good work there. Okay, we're actually going to stick with the idea of marketing a little bit longer in this first lecture. Before we begin, though, let's define our terms. When we hear the word technology today, you and I probably both picture smartphones. Like, good, that's perfect. That's exactly the kind of technology that I'm going to talk about tonight. Screen technology, which includes film, television, and computers. And now smartphones and smartwatches, and maybe even smaller smart things that I'm not aware of, younger people of whom there are not many right now, please send me an email if such things do exist, like to watch movies on smaller than a watch. The bottom line, though, is that by technology, I'm referring specifically to all forms of technology in which the basic unit is the pixel and the basic interface is the screen. But the word technology actually has a much broader application. It comes from the Greek word techne, which means art, skill, or craft. It can really refer to any product made by means of art, skill, or craft that is put to some practical purpose. That is anything we might call a tool. Clothing, for example, is a technology to keep us warm and decent. Silverware is a technology to keep our hands clean while we eat. Maybe it's because we have so many tools at our disposal today, and we mostly buy them rather than make them ourselves, that we tend to overlook such humble examples of technology, like clothing and silverware. We take them for granted. One humble but actually quite impressive technology that is woefully underappreciated these days, in my opinion, is the Codex, which is a fancy name for a book. There's a Gutenberg Bible from the Morgan Library in New York, but you could also picture a Penguin Classics paperback, too. It doesn't have to be as fancy as all that. Before the invention of the Codex, human beings recorded their thoughts on scrolls, papyrus, cuneiform tablets, the stone walls of buildings, and other physical media. Codices, that's just the plural of codex, are actually pretty ingenious inventions. They can hold a lot more writing than a cuneiform tablet, not quite as heavy, or an inscription on a building. They make it easier to go back and find something that you've previously read than a scroll. They're durable. When I was in graduate school years ago, I made ample use of both books and a laptop. One of those technologies is still working just fine a decade and a half later. The other one has turned into a very expensive paperweight for my 5-year-old daughter to pretend she is typing on. It doesn't work. Maybe somebody can make it work, but not me. So when I refer to fiction tonight, good fiction, I'm first of all talking about a physical book with words printed on paper. And a quick aside, I promise I will not judge you if you use an e-reader. Some people travel a lot. It makes sense. But I'm going to take the printed codex as my starting point because there's actually a lot of research showing that we remember what we've read better when we encounter words printed on paper rather than backlit on a screen. So when I refer to fiction, I'm referring first, in material terms, to a codex. As for what is printed inside that codex, I'm not talking about just any novel or short story or poem. I'm talking specifically about literary fiction, as the German critic Wolfgang Iser defined it. Iser defines literature as writing that is characterized by indeterminacy. That is, writing in which there's some kind of gap, and therefore the reader has to supply the missing logic, or an overlap of sorts in which there are layers of meaning for the reader to discover and sift through and weigh. A gap in prose is kind of easy enough to picture in your mind. Words might be missing, as in Mad Libs, or redacted, as in a confidential document. But multivalency is a little bit harder to wrap your head around without an example. So I'm going to give two examples. When I taught first year literature and composition, on the first or second day of class, I would draw an atom on the board to illustrate multivalency. And this was also a good chance for students who are much closer to their physics classes than I am at this point to, you know, teach the teacher or whatever. And they'd have to remind me, like, how many electrons in the first shell and how many in the second. And so in my understanding of Iser's multivalency, each electron shell is a possible meaning in a story or poem. And that'll be less, like, abstract in a second. So in Julia Alvarez's poem, Poetry Makes Nothing Happen, for example, we briefly meet May Quinn. In a moment of depression, May eyes the bathroom cabinet that still held her husband's meds. In discussing the poem, students naturally generate a backstory for May's husband. Even without theoretical instruction in the literary criticism of Wolfgang Iser, students instinctively respond to the rich ambiguity of the phrase. They try to make sense of what's missing. They don't even know that they're doing it. They just do it. And most students, in my experience, when they, you know, hear of a sort of lonely person eyeing the cabinet, most of them assume that her husband died of an illness. Some assume that he's left her. Once a student assumed that he was in jail. Between these various interpretations, meaning can jump as nimbly as electrons do, with the input of a different kind of energy from the reader. Here's another example of multivalency from a different poem that I used to like to introduce students to early on in the semester. It's called Filling Station, which is a slightly antiquated word for gas station, by Elizabeth Bishop. I'd ask students to read the poem once and then have them stand up and go to the chalkboard or the whiteboard or whatever was in there and draw what's happening in the poem. I started doing this exercise in part because an awful lot of college freshmen today, and my teaching is like from 2018, so that I don't know what, it doesn't sound like it's improved with COVID and everything since then, but an awful lot of college freshmen that I came across seemed to think that a poem is just a word salad, just a blizzard of words out of which no order may be made, no story or meaning discerned. It's just a blur from which one is forced to extract keywords for use on standardized tests. In between the keywords, students seem to expect chaos or dead space. And I wanted them to see that good fiction really ought to tell a story. It ought to play out in your mind like a movie. And Filling Station was perfect for achieving that goal. In the poem, the speaker looks around a dirty gas station. She's never stopped there before. Her first impression is that the place is a real dump and she just wants to get going again. Then she realizes it's a family business. Initially, that discovery only increases her disgust and judgment. She can't believe that anybody would choose to live in such a greasy mess. But as she takes in a number of small details, like a dirty dog napping comfortably on the patio furniture, a potted begonia, comic books resting atop the handmade doily decorating a table, oil cans lined up neatly in a row, she starts to soften. She can't help seeing all the little signs that someone cares. The last stanza of the poem reads, Somebody embroidered the doily. Somebody waters the plant, or oils it, maybe. Somebody arranges the rows of cans so that they softly say a so, so, so to high-strung automobiles. Somebody loves us all. Students consistently produced wonderful drawings of this poem. Here are some examples now. These drawings beautifully illustrate the multivalency of Bishop's last line. Somebody loves us all. The poem doesn't tell us precisely who the somebody is, and so it can support all of the interpretations that you see here, and also some others that I don't have a picture of, but I heard students suggest aloud in the classroom. Somebody could be the mom at the gas station. It could be the reader's own mom. It could be Mary, the Blessed Mother. It could be God himself. Or you could just shrug your shoulders and draw a question mark and say it's a mystery. We'll never know. I don't know if it's on that one or a different picture, but someone did that, a stick figure and a question mark. So that's what I mean by multivalency and indeterminacy. There should be some richness to the language when I'm talking about the kind of fiction that I would encourage people to read. You have to be able to read for more than just plot, which is why the newspaper doesn't count as literature. And maybe some thrillers that you might buy at the airport, you know, to read on the plane wouldn't count either. There has to be some room for the reader to exercise his or her judgment and play an interpretive role. Okay, so that's my definition of terms. Technology means screens, and fiction means a printed codex with a literary, that is to say, indeterminate text inside. Now back to marketing. One crucial moment in the history of marketing came in 1937. That's the year that Elmer Wheeler published a book called Tested Sentences That Sell: How to Use Word Magic to Sell More and Work Less. The scare quotes are his, and there's an exclamation point at the end of the title that I'm never sure how to adequately convey out loud. That's his too. Thank you for laughing. Like, I forgot how scary listening faces are. Like, I haven't been in a classroom, and you're just thinking, but you look like I'm torturing you. So that's why I'm like, okay, you're in it. You're in it still. All right, so there we are with Wheeler. And in the book, he offers a series of tips, which he modestly calls Wheeler points, for subtly influencing consumers.
In this clip, scholar and author Karen Swallow Pryor explored the connections between art, beauty, and the evangelical tradition. This sometimes complicated relationship has important things to teach us about both art and the beautiful. Karen is a reader, writer, and professor. In addition to a monthly column for Religion News Service, her writing has appeared at Christianity Today, The New York Times, The Atlantic, The Washington Post, First Things, Vox, and The Gospel Coalition. She is also a contributing editor for Comment Magazine.
Richardson's novel, Pamela, is considered what's called a sentimental novel, and that, again, grows out of the cult of sensibility. Charles Dickens, the greatest novelist, you know, arguably one of the greatest novelists of the Victorian age, was not an evangelical. He was a somewhat heterodox Christian, but he was very influenced by evangelicalism and sentimentality. And the same with Uncle Tom's Cabin over here in America, which is also considered a sentimental novel. A lot of people think it's great literature. And it was great literature because it moved people's hearts about the problem of slavery. But it did so by being sentimental rather than just by sheer force of what's right and wrong. It was like an appeal to hearts and emotions, which worked for a short time. It worked, but that's kind of the argument that I'm creating and building up here, is that sentimentality can be a shortcut to longer lasting, harder truths that really do bring about lasting change. Okay, let's see. I think I had another. Okay, yes. Yeah. So I'll talk a little bit more about this painting in a moment, but I want to talk about aesthetics, because we were talking about sensibility and sensitivity and sentimentality, and the word aesthetics arose in the 18th century, and it has a long history. It involves Immanuel Kant and philosophy, and it involves the study of our perception of beauty and so forth. And then later in the 19th century, there's a whole movement called aestheticism, which is art for art's sake. So there's a lot that's interesting there. But what I want to focus in on is that the word aesthetics which is, you know, its basic definition is that it's something pertaining to beauty, right? Something pertaining to beauty. And we tend, because we're visual creatures primarily, my dogs are like nose creatures primarily, but because we're visual creatures primarily, we often think of our key senses, our sense of sight. And so we might talk about the aesthetics of a room. I think these aesthetics are pretty good. They're like very modern in the best sense, but well done people. And rooms and architecture and buildings and people have all kinds of different aesthetics that we can perceive through the senses. But aesthetics more technically refers to any of our senses. So if you think of having anesthesia before you have surgery, which is a good thing, that word literally means like so that dulling your senses so you cannot feel things. So aesthetics really at its core means any kind of bodily response to stimuli. So we think of, you know, so we respond to the aesthetics of this room. It's either pleasing or not pleasing, but it applies to all of our senses. So it's helpful to remember that we may not be aware of it. It's usually very precognitive and we may not even sense it. But when we have an aesthetic response to something, it means we're having a bodily response. So like maybe we're just, the aesthetics of the room make us calm. Or if we go home and things are cluttered, it makes us not calm, right? Or we hear a sound and it's soothing, or we hear a sound and it's jarring. Sometimes we're aware of these bodily responses to aesthetic experience, but oftentimes we're really not even that aware of it because it's such at such a low register, or we're not paying attention. So aesthetics is really the word when we talk about beauty, and I want to begin to orient our attention toward that, because that's a much more transcendent understanding than something that just simply causes an emotion, causes us to weep at the stage, you know, what's performed on the stage, and then ignore our suffering servant outside, or the Hallmark commercial that makes us cry for no reason, or the Budweiser commercial during the Super Bowl with the puppies and the draft horses, and we get so annoyed. Why am I crying at this commercial? Well, because it's, they know how to trigger the response. That sort of sentimental response is not the same thing as what beauty does in causing an aesthetic response for us. So just to draw a little bit of a biblical connection to beauty, the Greek word kalon, and I don't know Greek, I just did the research here, but someone can correct me, but it refers to an ideal of beauty that is manifested both morally and physically. It sometimes gets translated into the word good. Right. So it might be we just say in throughout the Bible, in both the New Testament and the obviously the Old Testament isn't written in Greek, but there are parallels in the creation narrative in Genesis. Like when God says it is good, he actually means it is good morally and good aesthetically. Like, his creation is beautiful and it's also morally good. In the New Testament, in Matthew 12:33, which says, make a tree good and its fruit will be good. That's the word that's used there. It's good in every way. Good, beautifully. It's beautiful. It's healthy. It's good for us. And so the word suggests all the senses of beauty that are good for our body, good for our eyes, and so forth. So the link between aesthetic sensibility, which is feeling the right emotional response arise from sensory perception, and moral sense, which is making the right moral judgments, is something, I was kind of making fun of the cult of sensibility, but if we think about it in a different way, if we understand the beauty and the aesthetic and our right bodily and moral response and judgments to what we see and hear, that's the more transcendent understanding of what is beautiful. But often what happens is that we just confuse, to use a linguistic expression here, we confuse the sign of the thing for the thing, right? Like, so we just see something that triggers a response and we think that is the thing. So now what Bunyan was doing is he was using signs or symbols that were the thing. And that's why his work is a masterpiece, because he did it so well. Those symbols do express the transcendent truth of things, you know, for the most part. But when we stop using allegory and symbols so skillfully, that's when we can start to descend from beauty and truth and goodness to mere sentimentality. Going back to our history of evangelicalism, and I mentioned this before, but so just to bring us sort of up to speed, the evangelical revival begins in the early 18th century, continues growing in influence through the 18th century, really great gained the greatest influence in helping to abolish the slave trade. Like that was very important. But also the abolitionists were trying to bring about a number of other reforms. I think I already mentioned that they sought reform in animal welfare. William Wilberforce was one of the founding members of the Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, later called the RSPCA, and in America, the ASPCA, because they thought that being cruel to animals was bad. Go them, right? I mean, this was not considered a liberal agenda at the time. This was just basic Christianity. They sought, Wilberforce and Moore in particular, sought to bring reform to the wealthy, because they thought the wealthy should set an example for everyone else. Hannah Moore opened Sunday schools to teach the poor to read, because she wanted them to be able to read the Bible and recite the catechism and learn basic sort of domestic economy so their lives could improve. She was accused of being a revolutionary for that. That was way too radical for a lot of people, but she did this out of her evangelical faith. And so by the time we get to the Victorian age, which is a couple decades into the 19th century, evangelicalism had reached its sort of peak influence, or was still reaching its peak influence. Queen Victoria ascends, and all that we would associate with the Victorian age, I don't know if you associate things with the Victorian age or not. I think about it a lot. But if you associate anything with the Victorian, like this painting is quintessential Victorian. And I've got some other things to show you too. The Victorian age, in its best and its worst qualities, reflected the influence of evangelicalism. So, you know, as Charles Dickens famously said, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times, right? That's what he's saying about the Victorian age. And I think that we can see how evangelicals kind of reflected the best and worst about themselves. So one of the things that happens in evangelical and Victorian art is sort of what Bunyan was doing, is there's this element of didacticism, you know, so that art's purpose is to teach. And now this is, you know, there are lots of discussions around the purpose of art and what is art and all of these things. And that would be another set of 3 or 9 lectures. But something that's didactic has as its main purpose something, teaching a lesson. And Victorians were really into teaching lessons through their art. Or later, like Oscar Wilde, they're really into not teaching lessons through their art, or pretending they weren't teaching lessons through their art, but they really were, Oscar Wilde. Okay, but anyway, the most didactic novel I've ever read is A Picture of Dorian Gray by someone who claims not to be didactic, but that's another story. So this famous Victorian painting called The Awakening, The Awakening Conscience. I don't know how, I guess you can see that pretty well. It's really the story, I'll give you the short version. It's a beautiful painting, obviously the person who painted this has a lot of skill. I could never do anything like this. But what it is a painting, and all the cues are there. All the symbols are there. If you know how to read a painting and know what they mean, and other people have done that. This is a fallen woman, a kept woman, a mistress, who is having a moment of her conscience awakening. And she is rising up out of the lap of her keeper. I don't know what you call that. And he's kind of, he's going, what's going on? He's got kind of a smirk on his face. He's not had the awakening. We know she's a mistress because there are no rings and she's in her like mourning gown and there are other symbols all along. So she is leaving this life of sin. She's in this moment where she's going to leave and he still doesn't have a clue. He thinks it's funny or whatever. And so this is a beautiful painting, but it tells a story. It tells a story of a person having about with their conscience and awakening and having a conversion, essentially, right? An evangelical kind of moment. And so this is a painting that is an example of a didactic work of art that's supposed to tell us a story, to teach us a lesson about how to be awakened and revived and converted.